Welcome to the Razor's Ink podcast with your host, Jonathan Farini. Remember the future in Back to the Future 2? That was set in 2015. RoboCop, 2009. Blade Runner took place in 2019. And the first Terminator, a mere 3 years ago in 2021. How's that working for us? Pour yourself a drink, pull up a chair, and hear Jonathan's take on movies, television, and today, a vision of the future from the past. Here's your host, Jonathan Farini.
Imagine you're a studio executive, and I'm a writer-producer who came in to pitch an idea for a movie. Listen to my pitch carefully, because at the end, I'm going to ask you a very simple question. Let's begin. Present-day American big city. Streets are filled with the weary, hapless, and hungry during a sweltering, never-ending heat wave. People live in cars, if they're lucky, broken-down RVs parked precariously along the streets, sidewalk tents, and multiple occupants to small apartments, because rents have become unaffordable. We're not certain yet about the employment prospects, but they appear bleak. Or it's just not worth working because the pay and work just don't make sense, so everybody is on the dole. The government contractor shows up on scheduled times and dispenses potable water and boxed foodstuffs. And I'm not talking MREs or K-rations. Riots break out when the foodstuffs run out prematurely due to breakdowns within the supply chain. The wealthy, however, live in beautiful, glistening condo towers surrounded by security. Inside, you'll find all the comforts of a beautiful home, including computers, fashionable furniture, refrigerators bursting with meat, dairy, and vegetables, including a plentiful pantry, wine closet, and fully stocked bar. Incidentally, if you prefer, these opulent condos include a live-in maid whose repertoire include many talents such as au pair, cook, cleaning, and companionship. For the unfortunate, old and dying, there exists euthanasia on demand. Question: is my pitch plausible? Did you find it dystopian? Or, like myself, traveling up and down the coast of California from San Diego, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, eerily realistic? Think about your hometown, neighborhood, or anywhere you reside, and compare my pitch to what you see about. Question: okay, Jonathan, we see your point, but what's the backstory? In 1973, I was 15 years old, and paid to see what I thought was a B-movie released by MGM named Soylent Green, which describes the backdrop of the pitch I made to you.
What is the secret of Soylent Green?
New York City, in the year 2022. Nothing runs anymore. Nothing works, but the people are the same. And the people will do anything to get what they need.
This is the police.
What they need most is Soylent Green.
The supply of Soylent Green has been exhausted. Return to your home.
I was a kid well immersed in watching films since the 60s and had already made films. So my sensibilities about cinema were, I humbly submit, heightened beyond those of my peers. I didn't expect much from this film. The realities presented were ahead of their time. Aside from a trip to Skid Row or ghettos, I didn't see homeless people. Those with mental infirmities were inside state hospitals. There was a vibrant middle class who could afford the American dream. I grew up in the suburbs outside of LA, and my reality was a ranch home and large yard. My point is, I didn't focus on the dystopia inside the movie, but came away with two observations. First, I was watching a B-movie until an unexpected and what I call elegant edit occurred within the film, which I'll get to shortly. It starred Charlton Heston, who wasn't Ben-Hur anymore, but nevertheless a charismatic leading man who led the cast. His character is named Thorne. Yeah, kind of a teasing, obvious choice, Thorne in the side, but I'll live with it.
Detective Thorne, 14th Precinct. Sorry to make such a racket. I want to see Mr. Fielding.
She isn't home.
You're Mrs. Fielding.
I'm Martha Phillips. I live here.
Just met Tad yesterday in connection with a case. I had a few more questions I wanted to ask him. Would you know where he is now?
No.
When'll he be back?
I don't know. He just left.
Swell.
Edward G. Robinson was a senior citizen, and this was his 101st film. Watching Edward G. Robinson play a scholarly roommate named Saul Roth to Heston's police detective was marvelous, and Edward G. Robinson didn't miss a beat.
Yeah, I'm getting pretty sick of you.
Yes, but you love me.
Night shift again. I'll be damn late.
So get something to eat. Vaya con Dios.
What?
Go with God.
More about the irony of this role later. Rounding out the cast were Brock Peters. I talk about him playing a gangster in the 1965 film Pawnbroker podcast. He plays Heston's police chief, a minor role. Chuck Connors shows up as a much older version of the Rifleman, but watching him and Heston square off like a couple of bulls inside a ring, exerting their magnificent physicality and athleticism, is a wonderful pairing.
What was his full name?
William R. Simonson.
Occupation?
Rich.
Rich what?
Lawyer, politics. I had the impression he was more or less retired.
Say, does this building have a food inventory?
Yes, sir.
Wouldn't you know? Get me some booze.
No, I don't think that's within your jurisdiction.
Relax. You're not working for him anymore. Your contract's been canceled.
I've been paid to the end of the month.
Get the bottle?
Connors plays a security guard named Tab. Kind of awkward to me for a name anyways. To a wealthy resident of one of the opulent condos who is an attorney and sits on the board of a big ag food company, which dispenses the food rations in the form of wafers. They look like crackers. This executive is named William Simonson, played by the magnificent Joseph Cotten, who also sits on a secret, which gets him killed, leading Heston into the investigation of his murder and the unfolding of the story. Lee Taylor Young plays one of the live-in servants named Cheryl, I discussed earlier. More about this character to come. The screenplay written by Stanley Greenberg was adapted from a book titled Make Room, Make Room by Henry Harrison, which is about unchecked population growth and the hoarding of resources by the wealthy minority. 1966, folks. This was cruise night, soda fountains, Motown, British Invasion, fun rock and roll of the Beatles, Beach Boys, with some edgy Stones music. No acid rock, the war protests heated up, but the civil rights movements were underway, and the Watts riots soon to follow. The ingredients of the secret in Harrison's book was changed within the screenplay, to Harrison's dismay. Note to writers, a sale is a sale. If you have the clout and don't need the dough, hold out for the final say on script changes, obviously reserved for only the most successful of authors. I agree with the change included within the screenplay. It's the foundation of the movie. To say Henry Harrison's vision was prescient doesn't adequately describe his ability to foretell the future. Harrison's book and Cillian Green lend credence to the hackneyed saying, truth is stranger than fiction, but also bear out a maxim of this podcast, everything old is new again. The director was Richard Fleischer, who has a long and storied career. Check his filmography out. As I watched Heston peel back the murder of Simonson inside the opulent condo, he comes to know Cheryl. Ladies, these apartments come furnished, unfurnished, and if the man prefers, with a live-in, beautiful concubine, referred to as...
Furniture.
I've been with him for 4 years.
Furniture.
Yes.
Hey, this is really a terrific place.
That's Rice.
Yeah, I've seen him before. Tab does pretty well for himself, doesn't he?
He's got a good reputation.
Who with?
The people he works for.
Who's that?
You know, Chelsea West.
Yeah. Well, when he gets back, tell him Detective Thorne was here, okay?
Anything you say.
Cheryl assists Thorne with his investigation, and they have a tryst. Lee plays her intelligently, aptly, and beautifully, but the character just isn't central to the story. In this movie, clean running tap water pouring from the faucet inside a beautiful bathroom, a fragrant bar of soap, and a hot shower are manna from heaven. Thorne retrieves a slab of meat from the fridge, fruit, a bottle of whiskey, and takes them home to Saul, where we watch these two actors savor a leaf of lettuce, bite of meat, an apple, as if they were delicacies beyond reach.
L'chaim. Eaten like this in years.
He also takes two volumes of scholarly works about oceanography for Saul to study. A jar of strawberry preserves was referred to as costing $150. In some families today, I suggest this scene plays out nightly. Food for thought, pun intended. Jonathan, at age 15, has seen enough. Until a surprising edit of sorts occurs. If you know film or sound editing, it's a jump cut. It seems out of place. Saul and some intellectual friends discover that the oceans are dying and the plankton, which we're told are the ingredients of the wafers, dispensed to the public is false. He's old, tired, and wants to proverbially check out. We watch him walk a deserted, lonely street into the only illuminated building. It's beautiful, warm, inviting, illuminated, a multi-screen theater of sorts. And he's greeted by handsome and beautiful attendants in white robes who have him sign in.
Your favorite color?
Orange, I guess.
Music?
Classical. Light classical.
Oh, I'm sure you'll enjoy it. Sign here, please, Mr. Roth.
Full 20 minutes.
Oh, certainly. Guaranteed.
Saul is rolled into a small room resembling a mini amphitheater. He's offered a drink, including the euthanasia formulation. The lights dim, and we're treated to gorgeous, high-resolution cinematic portrayals of nature, including the mountains, oceans, wildlife, the setting sun, all accompanied by Tchaikovsky and Beethoven. Thorne finds a goodbye note from Saul and dashes off to join from a control booth as he witnesses Saul die, remembering the Earth as it was, not what it had become. They exchange.
Thorne? Yes.
Thank you for coming.
Oh, dear God.
I've lived too long.
No.
I love you, Thorne. I love you, sir.
It's breathtaking, and at age 15, I exclaimed, This B movie became a B plus or A minus. I haven't read the book nor the script, and this scene may appear on the page. The romantic in me always hopes it was just thought up on the set, which is often the alchemy of movie making. Maxim of this podcast, nothing happens in film by accident. Edward G. Robinson was actually dying of cancer during the making of this film and passed 2 months after wrapping production. Edward G. Robinson is an American original and the subject of a future podcast. The second edit, or jump cut, is Thorne following Saul's body, which is placed inside an ordinary trash truck along with other bodies wrapped in sheets and taken to a factory. The bodies are dumped into a tank but just float about. No acid, agitation, nothing. Here's the second edit or jump cut. Heston is chased by Tab throughout the factory, shot, kills Tab, and witnesses a conveyor belt of green wafers, which are the Solient Green. Climax.
They've got to tell people.
Tell them what?
The ocean's dying. The plankton's dying. It's people. Soylent Green is made out of people.
They're making our food out of people. Next thing, they'll be breeding us like cattle for food. You gotta tell them. You gotta tell them.
Promise, Tiger. I promise. I'll tell the exchange.
You tell everybody. Listen to me, Hatcher. You gotta tell them. Soylent Green is people. We've gotta stop them somehow.
Writers, if you tee up the skin, show the act. In other words, give us some explanation of the chemical process of turning the bodies into wafers. You could do it visually with no words. Just cuts to compressors, grinders, sound editing with appropriate crunching, grinding, etc. The jump cut here was like jumping across the Grand Canyon. Sloppy. I'm surprised it made it past the director, producers, and suits at MGM. What's the point, Jonathan? Soylent Green is now! The film was set in 2022. Overpopulation, global warming, ecocide all show up, as do a class system quickly becoming just two, haves and have-nots. Think about the private islands, private jets, the corporate farmers, corporate pharma, breakdown of supply chains, debates about alternative foodstuffs. This isn't political, it's reality. This B film speaks loud and clearer today than it did in 1973. If you haven't seen it in a while, it's a must-see given the world in which we live. If you've never seen it, watch it at your earliest opportunity. By the way, when you grab that breakfast or protein bar as a convenient way to skip a meal, remember Soylent Green and this podcast. Until I see you next time, please leave behind a soft footprint, and class is dismissed.
And that line, Soylent Green is people, number 10 on the list of movies famous for one quote. You've been listening to the Razor's Ink podcast with Jonathan Farini. Be sure to check out Jonathan's collection of fiction at jonathanfarini.com. There you'll find everything from drama to romance, something for every reader, including his latest short story set in Sin City, Guzzled. That's jonathanfarini.com, Farini with two R's, one N. Or drop an email to razorsincpodcast@gmail.com.